The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they're easy, but
we have made
it to
start. 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston, broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to our Sunday Open Lines program. I am your host, David Livingston, and thanks for tuning us in. I look forward to hearing what's on your mind today and having some good discussions with you. A couple of announcements. For those of you who would like to call us, it is toll-free 1-866-687-7223. Remember, no call screener. Be patient and let it ring. I'll answer the phone and get you up on air as quickly as possible. I can hold you over the break if that's applicable, and I also will answer the phone during the break. Remember, there's only one toll-free line, so if you're calling and it's busy and you think you've waited long enough, please send me an email and tell me you're waiting, and I'll hasten along the guest who is using the toll-free line. You can also use email, drspace@thespaceshow.com, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, and you can also post comments on the blog. Go to the far right to upcoming shows. Today's program is the first program listed, so open up that page by clicking on it. That is our archive for today's show. And then scroll down and you'll see the place for comments. And I will get your comment almost immediately and can introduce it to the program today. So those are the three ways that you can communicate with us. So real quickly, just remember that there is a menu on the upper left, and under the support menu is our store in case you're interested in Space Show t-shirts, coffee mugs, hats, and things of that nature. Also, listen live instructions are there. This tells you how to listen to a live Space Show program as well as an archived program. Feel free to share the information. And then also, there is a big link, I guess you would say, or block link on the right, center right of the homepage for supporting the Space Show. Remember, we are a 501c3 nonprofit with OneGiantLeapFoundation.org, and we exist because many of you are generous and you do support the Space Show financially, and your support keeps us on the air, and we deeply appreciate your support. Remember, as a 501c3, if you pay U.S. federal taxes, you do get a tax deduction for your gift, and the same is true for those of you who pay California taxes. In the Golden State, we're known as a public benefit corporation. So if you have any questions, check us out at our parents' homepage, OneGiantLeapFoundation.org, or feel free to email me, drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, @thespaceshow.com. And on the website, there is a detailed newsletter that will be uploaded after today's program. It has all of the information in detail for the upcoming week's program. Note, there is no show on Friday, January 20th. Because of the presidential inauguration, I figured we'd lose a big part of our live audience for the inauguration, so we'll just take it as sort of a federal holiday. So there is no show on Friday, January 20th. And but do check out the newsletter and then the upcoming show menu on the far right. And also, if you open up the website newsletter and scroll down, you'll see the list of all of the planned programs for the first quarter of this year that are already set. And then remember, everything we do is archived. You can easily listen right off of our website or very rapidly download the shows. There's an Amazon link. Amazon has 2 great programs for supporting nonprofits. If you click on that link and you buy items from Amazon, check it out. Maybe one of those 2 methods will appeal to you. And the Amazon support does help. And we're grateful and appreciative that Amazon does have that kind of program. We do have sponsors for our show, and check out their sponsors' ads running across the homepage from time to time, because they are great sponsors. But two sponsors are bringing you the first segment of today's Open Lines program, the Space Finance Group. And since you're listening to the Space Show, you are obviously passionate about space, and so are we, meaning the Space Finance Group. We can help you get the funding you need to make your space idea happen. Members of our team have helped people raise over $1 million using Kickstarter and similar platforms. You've been to space conferences. You know there's no shortage of ideas, but there has been a shortage of seed capital. We can help you get the resources you need to get started. They are online at spacefinancegroup.com. That's all one word. And you can reach us at the email address jay.witner@spacefinancegroup.com. If you want to talk about space, call your friends. If you're ready to make your idea happen, call us. And then we are also sponsored by the Space Foundation. They have their 33rd Space Symposium coming up. Make critical and profitable connections at the 33rd Space Symposium. This is April 3rd through the 6th in Colorado Springs, Colorado. Their website, spacesymposium.org. If you're planning to go, you should make your reservations early. Colorado Springs is not that big a town. Hotels go get sold out. There is an airport in Colorado Springs, but flights get sold out because there's upwards of maybe 15,000 people in attending. I am the moderator of a panel. I believe it is on the last day of the conference, and it will involve all the NASA Center directors, and more on that as we get closer to that symposium. So today is Open Lines, and before I throw out some ideas that I have for discussion today, including a couple that come out of the Wall Street Journal, number one, I certainly do want to congratulate SpaceX for just an incredible launch yesterday out of Vandenberg and an incredible recovery of the first stage. The video held up. We got to see the whole thing coming down, and it was right smack in the bullseye. And if you have not seen a video of the launch yet and the recovery, I urge you to go do so. It was phenomenal, and our congratulations to SpaceX. A job very, very well done with return to flight, and it was really great being able to watch it all live. We do have Dr. Bill Rowe, one of our favorite guests on the Space Show, is our first caller to the program today. He had some important things he wanted to convey to us, and I've got Bill on the phone as our first caller. Bill, welcome back to the Space Show. How are you, and Happy New Year to you.
Great, David. And what I'd like to do is just spend about 10 minutes. I've got three subjects that I want to discuss, and when the 10 minutes are up, give me a warning, and I'll try to close out. The first thing that I'd like to discuss, you'll have to go to my website, www.femsinspace.com, or you can just type William J. Rowe, but you have to put the J in, and you'll get right there to my website. And then when you do, I'd like you to scroll down right in the center and scroll down to where there are about five or six items before it, to the Neil Armstrong syndrome. This syndrome has been very, very popular. It was just went online about a year ago, and now it was published in the International Journal of Cardiology several months ago. What I want to stress is, when you go to this Neil Armstrong syndrome, go down, scroll down to the summary, which is just on the second page, and you'll see down at the bottom, the very bottom of the summary, or almost at the bottom, determining the ideal calcium-magnesium intake ratio, (2:1, 3:1, or 4:1, and I want to elaborate what that means. It's been known since the 80s that when you take calcium and magnesium, I have stressed for years that women, for example, shouldn't take calcium supplements because their doctors are often telling them to do this for the bones. But what happens is that you can't survive without magnesium and without enough magnesium. At least 60% of Americans have a magnesium deficiency. If you take an excess amount of calcium, you'll reduce the gastrointestinal absorption of magnesium. So we know that since the 80s, the calcium-magnesium intake ratio should be about 2-1. But what is it in space? Nobody has ever calculated that. And I have published a few months ago in the International Journal of Advanced Research that a six-month rat study will, I believe, provide the answer. Now, research in space has a tremendous advantage because the lifespan is reduced by a factor of 10. And therefore, a rat might survive on Earth for up to three years, but in space, they may be gone in 6 months. So this shortens the whole study, and it reduces the cost appreciably. And I have published, the thrust of my paper is that if you correlate the calcium-magnesium intake ratio in three different groups of rats while they're on exercising every 12 hours for a half hour on a treadmill on the International Space Station, we can get the answer by looking at their telomeres. So if you scroll down a couple more to the illustration of the telomeres, you'll see that magnesium is tied in with that. I don't want to go into any more detail other than to tell you that NASA encourages International Space Station studies, and this provides, as far as I know, the first example of how it can be utilized without having to use pharmaceuticals. The second thing that I want to emphasize is this. All my research in the last 20 to 25 years, has been what happens in space to the cardiovascular system, the adverse effects. And I haven't until recently looked into what happens in space as far as cancer is concerned. Now, there are at least three problems in space which may trigger cancer. One is insulin resistance. Insulin doesn't work in space, and it's been shown that insulin resistance, or in diabetes, for example, this can trigger cancer. This has been published over and over again, that insulin resistance occurs in space. A second one, and which I have addressed for 20 years plus, is a magnesium deficit. It invariably occurs. And the third thing is a vitamin D deficiency. Now, all of you can benefit by brief discussion that you all should be taking magnesium supplements, and you all should be taking vitamin D supplements, except in the summer. If you're out in the sun a lot in the summer, you don't need it, but in the winter you certainly do. And therefore, insulin resistance, magnesium deficiencies, vitamin D deficiencies all can trigger cancer, and all three occur in space. The third thing that I want to just touch on is the fact that I have been frustrated as hell with NASA as far as closing the door for an independent researcher such as myself. There have been 12 moonwalkers, and I have published at least 15 or so papers, I think 8 alone on Neil Armstrong already, as to what has happened to the 12 moonwalkers as far as the cardiovascular effects are concerned. Irwin on Apollo 15, he had a heart attack 21 months after Apollo 15. I didn't have to pay anything, and I got a wealth of information. And with Neil Armstrong, 2 days after the funeral, I asked NASA to send me information as to what his cardiovascular effects were beginning 6 weeks before mission, and including 6 weeks afterwards. And I only had to pay $150, and it has led to an enormous amount of interest throughout the world. As a matter of fact, I've been asked to contribute to the revised biography of Neil Armstrong. It's a 700-page biography. It'll be published, revision by Simon & Schuster, in 2019. So that's exciting. And for Ed Mitchell, I had to pay $700 before NASA would send me one word, and the information that I asked was incomplete, and I sent an email back to them and at Johnson Space Center, and they wanted several hundred dollars more for more information. So I complained to a friend of mine at NASA headquarters, and I just sent this about 2 weeks ago, and he has assured me, he's been a close friend for at least 10 years, he's not in the medical department, but he's at NASA headquarters, that he's going to pass the word. So those are the three things that I wanted to mention, and David, I'll turn it over to others.
Okay, but real quickly, when you say the calcium-magnesium ratio of 2-1, is that for Earth or for space?
That's for Earth. For Earth, it's been known, the French have emphasized this beginning in the 80s, that and all the magnesium experts throughout the world agree that it should be not more than 2-1. So if you take an excess amount of calcium, you will reduce the gastrointestinal absorption of magnesium. And I have published a seminal paper that correcting magnesium deficiencies will prolong life. There are at least 60% of people in the United States alone who have a magnesium deficiency, and you don't need calcium supplements. You can have all the calcium you want in your food, but don't take the calcium supplements. And when your wife or your girlfriends are told as they age to take calcium supplements because of concern about fractures from osteoporosis, let it go in one ear and out the other. The doctors who are saying this don't understand the problems and how it can interfere with magnesium deficiencies.
So if you're told you have osteoporosis and to start taking calcium...
If you're told you have osteoporosis, take magnesium supplements, and you can take all the calcium you want in your food, but don't take the supplements, because with the supplements you're going to interfere with the gastrointestinal absorption of magnesium, but you can have all that you want in your food. And magnesium is very, very important for bone structure. It will reduce the risk of fractures. My mentor, Mildred Seelig, the real pioneer in magnesium, at age 83, she did not take any. If my wife, as she ages, takes magnesium supplements, I'm going to be out the door.
So,
or she's not listening.
And so you're talking about two parts calcium to one part magnesium on Earth, right?
Absolutely, on Earth. But in space, we don't know what it is. The reason we don't know what it is, and the reason that it triggered my paper, is the fact that in space, there is a progressive loss of bone no matter how much one exercises. It's the present recommendation that you're going to need at least 1 to 2 hours. You're going to need at least 2 hours of exercise a day, every single day. That still isn't enough. We know that too much, I've published that both too much and too little exercise will damage a normal heart. And Ludlow has published that if you, with both too much and too little exercise will shorten the telomeres. So it's impossible to write an exercise prescription in space. But the thing is that as the weeks and months go by, and if we go to Mars, as the years go by, there is progressive loss of bone. And with the loss of bone, there's going to be a loss of calcium. So with this progressive loss of calcium, there is going to be a much greater shortage of calcium in space than there is in Earth. And I don't know whether it will be 3-1 or 4-1, or God knows it may be 5-1 recommendation, but I think we can find out with these rats in 6 months. And they're going to do it for nothing. We don't have to pay these rats anything.
Bill, before you go, let me ask you another question. I had an email question with a guest on about 2 weeks ago. It was an older woman listening to the show in Seattle, and she wanted to know if the bone loss issues that get reported all the time in space included bone loss issues for teeth, because she said she had advanced periodontal disease and had bone loss with teeth, and wondered if the space research was showing anything about bone loss for teeth and if that's the same thing as osteoporosis except for teeth.
Everything goes to hell in space. Everything. And it's everything. We don't belong there. I can assure you that the teeth will eventually decay. Every part of the body decays. We don't belong there. It's a very simple answer to your question, David.
So bone loss in teeth happens, too, in space.
Yeah. For example, there are four syndromes, space syndromes, that I'm aware of. On Earth, there are well over 1,500 syndromes. Syndromes are specific symptoms and signs, before you can call it a syndrome. There are well over 1,500. In space, there are only four that I'm aware of. I had a medical librarian expert go through this, and as far as I know, there are only four, and I've published two of them. I'm bragging right now, but I'm excited about it. One is my Neil Armstrong syndrome, and the other is the Apollo 15 space syndrome. And so I've addressed the problems with these two syndromes, and it's been very exciting, David.
Bill, I'm getting a call in, Bill. I wonder if they want to talk to you. Want to see if this caller wants to talk to you?
Yeah, I'll be glad to, David.
Hang on.
I know that I'm not supposed to be a guest this time, but sure, I'll be glad to.
Let's see if this person is calling for you or for some other reason. Hi, caller. Welcome to the Space Show. Did you want to talk to Dr. Rowe?
Hello, yeah, I want to speak about the guy who's speaking at the moment.
Well, he's on the line. Hold on, he's on the line. You can talk directly to him. What is your name and where are you?
I called you a couple of weeks ago. My name is Marcia Teotonio, and I called you about...
Okay, well, Dr. Rowe is on the line. You can talk directly to him. Do you understand me? Hello?
Yeah, I understand you.
Do you have your computer turned off? Turn off your computer.
Okay, sorry, one second.
You can't understand anything we're doing. You need to kill your sound on your computer.
Sorry about that.
So are we.
Okay, can I speak now?
Yeah, speak directly to Dr. Rowe. He can hear you.
Hello,
yes,
Dr. Rowe.
Go ahead with your question.
Yeah, what is your question?
My question is... do you think that we have the resources at the moment to make it healthy and cover greater distances in space? I mean, as humans, the way we still are at the moment in terms of genetics and space.
I'm sorry, David, what is he saying? I can't quite hear.
I think he wants to know if we have the resources and capability as of today to make it safe for humans to be in space.
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. It depends upon whether you're talking about a prolonged mission as opposed to colonizing. If you're talking about a prolonged mission, for example, a round trip to Mars will be at least 20 months. At least 20 months, because you have to wait until the Earth and Mars are in closest together, and that would be at least 20 months. Even for that, these people who were making predictions that we can go to Mars in 8 years or 10 years, and including one of the world's great heroes, Buzz Aldrin, I don't see how Buzz Aldrin, for example, can write a book and state that in X number of years we'll be ready to go to Mars. I think that that's really not based upon what we know today. So I can't give you an answer as to how long it'll take, but it's certainly, I believe, it will take decades before we'll be ready to even go to Mars. There are just too many problems, and I could spend days trying to answer the question.
You see, I believe the mission that they're doing at the moment, the one with the 2 year, 6 months with the 2 year path, I do believe it's a suicidal mission because there's no way humans will be able to be refined into a, you know, strict space for 6 months, and I don't believe that they will have. That's going to have human life support resources within the spaceship to cover all that. You know, I believe that should be other technologies in place in order to start considering doing that.
Well, are you agreeing then with my concept?
Yes, I agree. To be honest.
For example, going to Mars, whether we go nuclear or whether we go some other way, so a lot depends upon our technology, but as far as the limiting factors of human beings are concerned, I think we've got a long way to go. The other thing is that I have spent exchanged emails quite frequently with Paul Deere from England, who's called in the program. And as a matter of fact, I'm going to London in a few months and going to have dinner with Paul Deere. Paul feels, for example, he's been with the MRC laboratory working on the genome, and now he's started his own company. And the problem is whether we're going to go and eventually colonize, whether we're going to go, even without discussing colonization, whether we're going to use gene therapy or whether we're going to duplicate exactly Earth genes. And I feel very strongly, and I've been on this program many times, stating that I think that we must duplicate exactly Earth G, and that 9/10 or 99% isn't enough, and it must be exactly Earth G. As far as gene therapy is concerned, Paul has emphasized to me that even to build one gene and replace just one gene, we don't have the technology at this point to even do that. And if we talk about, if we're considering a 20-month round trip to Mars, and we're not going to duplicate exactly Earth G and use, for example, gene therapy, we don't have the technology to do this. And then the other problem is if we duplicate exactly Earth G in transit, what about exploring? Can we build tunnels? And can we explore on Mars or an asteroid by duplicating exactly Earth G? I don't think there would be any problem as far as transit is concerned, but as far as exploring is concerned, that's the problem, and I think that's the hang-up. I hope I've answered your question. That's about as far as we know at this point, but to be perfectly honest, nothing really, no system is free of progressive destruction in space.
No, I do believe that as well. But you see, I think what we have to concentrate at the moment is I'm not even going to speak about trying to say that humans have to evolve into a stronger species in terms of, you know, human biological factors, the human body. But I do believe that we need, bigger spaceships are in space. And, it comes the factor again of artificial gravity within the spaceship in order to surpass certain barriers that we as humans still having when it comes to cover greater distances are in space. And there's also biological research in terms of space carriers you know, to have it within a spaceship. So, and therefore, I believe we would need bigger spaceships.
You're addressing the hardware for transportation, and that's fine. I don't necessarily agree that we need a much larger, a very, very large spaceship. But what I'm concerned about,
I can't address
that hardware. What I'm concerned about from our human limitations is, and let me give you an example. Magnesium, for example, you cannot survive without magnesium, and you cannot survive without pharmaceuticals, and you cannot survive without the vitamin D3 that I mentioned, for example. We don't have, at this point, because of microgravity, the gastrointestinal tract doesn't function. Therefore, everything that we give must be injected subcutaneously. If we have a 20-month round trip to Mars, you can't possibly poke an astronaut every 2 or 3 or 4 hours for 20 months because they're just not going to tolerate it. No one's going to volunteer. We need a subcutaneous replenishable device, a device which has perhaps thousands of mini compartments, and we can store minerals and various pharmaceuticals in that device, and it is all put together in a company. And then the problem is, however, you can do this, but it cannot be replenished. There's no way to replenish whatever you're going to use. You can have an anode cover, press a button, the anode cover melts, and out comes whatever is in it, the minerals or magnesium, but the problem is replenishing it. So there is nothing available at this point. Until we develop a replenishable, subcutaneous, probably silicon device, we can't go anywhere.
I understand what you're saying, but I was talking about, replacing Earth effects within the spaceship.
Well, you're talking about centrifuge?
I'm talking about obviously his advanced research,
quite large to duplicate exactly Earth gravity. The problem is the fuel consumption and the size of the fuel consumption.
I know, but I believe it could be otherwise in terms of energy source within the spacecraft. There's always the issue of the fuel and the energy, so that when it comes to carbureted distances in space, because
it
won't last forever,
and we
haven't been able
exactly
to
Earth
generate
gravity, the centrifuge. Won't the centrifuge have to be quite large to duplicate exactly Earth gravity?
Well, it doesn't have. It can duplicate it being a short arm, but you have to have it a certain size so that the people can tolerate being in the damn thing.
Yes, that's correct. If it's too fast,
yeah,
you can't tolerate it.
Therefore comes the mother fish. You know, never meant to enter any planet's atmosphere.
Guys, I got to move on to other topics. I'm getting a lot of emails for people who want to use the phone.
David, thanks very, very much. Goodbye.
Okay, thank you, Bill.
Thanks a lot for your answers.
Thank you very much, and thanks for your call. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Listeners, that does open the lines, but there's also some topics that I would like to throw out for you. So, first of all, I saw the movie Hidden Figures a couple of days ago, which is just out, and if it's in your area, I really urge you to go see this movie. It was really terrific. And all the technical stuff, the acting stuff, some of the footage from the Mercury day, and the flights that were made, and the failures of the Redstone rocket, and other things that are in there were terrific, brought back memories. The Mercury 7 famous press conference was there, brought back a lot of memories. It was really a good movie. And also it really depicted the role of segregation in our society back in the early 60s. And, I thought that was very accurately depicted in the movie as well, since many of you never lived through that period. This really gives you an idea of what it was like, even at NASA. So we can talk more about it if you want to know more about it. I don't want to ruin it for anybody, although you do know the storyline. So you pretty much know what happens in the movie. But it's exceptional, and I urge you to go see Hidden Figures when it comes to your area. The Wall Street Journal ran a couple of articles a couple of days ago, and I want to thank listener John Josie for this, because he sent me the two articles by Andy Pasture and Rolf Winkler. And they talk about the finances of SpaceX. Now, they don't tell you how they got the information. And when Musk and others were asked to comment on it, they didn't comment on it. But there are two articles that were written. Let's see, one was written January 14th. And when was the other one written? Was written January 13th. So the one on the 13th is titled, in case you want to search for it, again, it's Wall Street Journal, Exclusive Peek at SpaceX Data Shows Loss in 2015, Heavy Expectations for Nascent Internet Service. Internal documents reveal aerospace company has thin bottom line, vulnerable to accidents, hopes planned satellite internet business will finance eventual Mars mission. Then the January 14th article is SpaceX resumes rocket launches by losting cluster of Iridium satellites. Blast off, first for Falcon 9 since explosion in September, puts 10 commercial satellites into orbit. So the graphs and charts for financial earnings, market share, and things like that were fabulous in these articles. And we can talk about them at length if you want to. Again, I don't know where Andy and the other journalists, how they got the information, because SpaceX is pretty much a private company. One of the things that was revealed is that the savings that SpaceX is getting so far on recovered first stages is 10%. So here's what the article said. For now, projections of huge price cuts from reusing launchers remain only promises. So far, SpaceX has announced lowering launch prices for such missions by about 10%, and the internal company documents anticipate reusable rockets will only have a marginal positive impact on SpaceX's profitability over the next few years. So for all of you who think that reusability is going to save 30-40%, SpaceX is going to be able to substantially reduce launch prices and still make a bundle, apparently that's not being borne out by reality. So I'll read this paragraph again. For now, projections of huge price cuts from reusing launchers remain only promises. So far, SpaceX has announced lowering launch prices for such missions by only about 10%, and the internal company documents anticipate reusable rockets will have only a marginal positive impact on the SpaceX profitability over the next few years. But these financial articles and the graphs and charts, especially in the earlier article from the 13th, are fascinating and show the proportion of revenue coming from satellite launches versus launch services and other things going on. I would urge all of you, if you can access the Wall Street Journal articles, to do so. And I think you'll find them very informative. So since we don't know how the authors got the data, I can only assume that there has been some due diligence checking and verification in order to publish the material in the Wall Street Journal. So they must have reliable sources, because I think the Wall Street Journal is credible and reliable. So if you're interested in SpaceX finances, I would really urge you to go do that and check it out. So I'm wondering if anyone out there also is up on any news with the President-elect Trump landing team, transition team for space? Because I haven't heard anything recently. Maybe some of you have, and you can update us. Our guest tomorrow, Courtney Stad, has been through presidential transitions for space a couple of times before, and he is on to specifically talk about presidential transition and landing teams regarding the space segment of the program. So he's our guest tomorrow at 2 p.m. California time. Then there is a fresh UFO article by The Mirror, which is a UK paper. Now, I don't know UK papers very well, but I think The Mirror is sort of like the National Enquirer over here, but maybe not, because I know that English tabloids have, I think, more credibility than American tabloids. But anyway, it is an article that appeared in The Mirror on the International Space Station and UFOs, and you might want to find it and talk about it, or at least be familiar with it from your own perspective. The headline, which you can search for, is Mystery Flashing Lights Speed Past International Space Station Before Astronaut Hides Evidence from Camera with Hand. So that's their headline. Mystery Flashing Lights Speed Past International Space Station Before Astronauts Hides Evidence from Camera with Their Hand. So, of course, the UFO whack jobs say this proves that we're not alone and that astronauts are trying to hide that fact. So take that one with a grain of salt. The article was written by Eve Buckland, B-U-C-K-L-A-N-D, and that's got a January 15th, 2017 date. And again, it's for The Mirror, which is a UK paper. So if anyone wants to find that article and you want to talk about that specific article and flashing lights and astronaut photography of it and then blocking the flashing lights, you're welcome to call in. But this is not going to be a UFO show. So if you don't want to talk specifically about that article and the ISS, save it for a paranormal show, because I don't want to go down that the road of doing a show on UFOs. It's not what we're interested in here. But I think these ISS stories are interesting. I have no way of knowing the accuracy of it, but I am reporting it to you. Our phone number, and we are interesting at the halfway point, I can't believe half the show is over with, is 1-866-687-7223. Remember, there are no call screeners. You can give us a call if you'd like. We do want to hear from you. This is an open lines program. And email Dr. Space, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. Since we are at the halfway point, I'm going to go ahead and take a break. And then you can, we'll come back, and hopefully you'll be able to call us and send in your emails. And look for us in about 3 minutes. And again, the phone number, and remember, we do answer the phone during the break, 1-866-687-7223.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
The mission of the Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
Welcome back, everybody. Part two for Open Lines Sunday. Our phone number is 1-866-687-7223. Email drspace@thespaceshow.com. And for blog comments, upcoming menu, thespaceshow.com, far right side, and then click on the first show, which is Open Lines. We have two sponsors for the second portion of this show. So the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics is the world's largest aerospace professional society, and they have over 30,000 engineers from 88 countries, and they convene 5 yearly forums, which are really conferences. They publish books, technical journals, and the Aerospace America magazine. They have a collection of over 150,000 technical papers. They develop and maintain standards, honors, and celebrate achievement, and they advocate on space policy issues. And they are noted for this, and their conferences are great. I should say their forums are great, wonderful networking opportunity. So we urge you to check it out. Become a member, attend their events, AIAA.org. And also, Orbital ATK is a sponsor, the global leader in aerospace and defense technology, and they are known as a partner you can count on for advanced, reliable space propulsion systems for space exploration, commercial ventures, and defense programs. So we have caller Marshall from Texas waiting on the line to be our second caller of the day. Hi, Marshall, and good to have you back on the air.
Yes, I was talking to my son earlier today, and he was talking about the success of the latest SpaceX launch, and we got to talking about going to Mars, and a part of the earlier conversation in this show was basically I was wondering about how long it would take once we do have an artificial gravity system, probably on the International Space Station, does it take before you can come in and start launching people towards Mars? That's just the one problem. And then the second problem is the radiation problem. And you have to come in there and solve both of those before Elon Musk can send his colonists to Mars. And there isn't even test systems out there yet. So I was talking at least 10 years just to get up to test systems to say, we're ready. And at this point, I kind of go, hey, what's other people think?
What does your son think?
Oh, he thinks that Elon Musk is going to get out there and solve all this stuff. You know, click, click, click. He's, you know, great, wonderful. Of course, he is a libertarian and thinks Ron Paul is great. So, yeah, we have a little too much Kool-Aid in the mix.
Well, but there's, you know, millions of people who probably think that Elon Musk is going to resolve these issues and or at least have mitigation strategies for them and still be able to meet his deadlines, although he slips on deadlines all the time. So I would assume it's going to take him longer than the stated timeline he has suggested.
But it's a lot faster than NASA.
Well, I'm not sure NASA, despite their rhetoric, is that committed to doing it. But and will NASA have the funding for it? But, of course, Elon needs the funding for it, too, because he has said it's a much bigger funding job than what SpaceX and he can handle on his own. Do you think that if there were proper resources, let's put it on a global basis, not just on the United States, but if there were proper resources being applied to dealing with the gravity prescription, as Dr. Jim Logan likes to talk about, and to radiation shielding or mitigation strategies on a global basis, no shortage of postdocs and people doing the research that really knew what they were doing, and no shortage of funding needed to advance the state of research, again, on a global basis, do you think that within a decade we would have effective mitigation strategies or workarounds?
I think if the funds were available, and like you said, you released the intellectual capacity of everybody in the world, you could probably get pretty close in about 10 years. But I can't see the funding ever being there, and there's so much political noise in the middle of it. I really don't think it can happen. And I also come in there and say, you can't go to Mars until you start, what's the right word? I think it's called in situ. You have to start mining asteroids and probably have to start mining the moon to get enough material for radiation shielding and maybe even come in there and have nuclear power plants to not only supply electricity to the spaceship, but maybe even to drive it. So, yeah, it's possible, but there's not enough will in the people.
What about mixtures of public-private partnership money?
It would probably take, two or three times as much time. I think it will eventually happen. But, will it happen in our lifetime? I don't know. I think it's less than a 50-50 chance.
Many people believe, and will probably see this possibly posted on the blog as a comment after this show, maybe by more than one person. I've seen it show up on the blog before. And people say as long as the participants going to Mars are fully disclosed, and if they want to take the risk, then go and sort of get on the job training and take the risk and go and advance the state of the art that way. That's kind of like, I think, what Mars One is talking about doing. Of course, as I said, I don't think they'll ever leave the ground. But what do you think of that idea? Fully disclosed, if people want to go, given that possibly in 10 years or 15 years when they could go with Musk, assuming Musk meets his goals, if they want to take that risk and know they may die, what's the difference of that and going to climb Mount Everest?
I don't see any difference at all. It's just that knowing how to get up Mount Everest is a known procedure. Basically, traveling even to the moon is just barely within our intellectual range. And coming in there and putting space probes to Mars, outside of the United States, I don't remember a Russian probe making it. The British probes have not been overly successful, so, it's a high-risk venture just to put a robot to Mars.
Well, India got to Mars.
Oh, they did? Oh, yeah, I guess they did.
They're with an orbital mission. They didn't land on Mars.
Yeah, well, and getting something in orbit around Mars is child's play compared to landing. So the Beagle being a prime example there. The technical problems have to be solved before you can get people up there. And I think the first big experiment that has to be put in place is inventing some kind of artificial gravity so that you can just travel in space. If I remember correctly, I think it was somewhere around 95 or something like that, they were talking about putting up an artificial gravity system on the International Space Station, and it got canceled. So you got to put the artificial gravity experiment somewhere. Maybe it'd be something, just floating in orbit, and you spin it up. I think they did that in the Gemini project once with a tether. Maybe you end up doing something like that and it's called the Dragon. Go up, dock with it, and people stay there 6 months to prove that artificial gravity solves 90% of the problem.
Or go to Mars and see if 38% gravity works.
Well, that's a bit spooky, but you got to worry about the people having the mortality of people trying to get to Mars.
So
my concern.
I guess the question is, if you have all these people willing to do this and assume the risk, and it backfires, and you know they either die on the way to Mars, or they're severely incapacitated, or they can't get to Mars and can't even get out of the spaceship, or whatever disaster you want to. You can get the writers of National Geographic to give you all the disasters you need. So the
yes.
The question is, to the degree that something like that really happened, would the fallout from that reality be so devastating that other missions and other ventures would not get launch licenses from any country and be able to go to Mars or do anything unless and until these problems were actually not just mitigated but resolved? So could there be a big backfire?
I think it would be a huge backfire. Nothing like a big failure to, you know, totally put everything on hold and, you know, it's like, what was his name? The guy that the Wright brothers actually flew an airplane and he kept trying to make his airplanes, and they just flat wouldn't fail, and basically everybody was saying, oh, you can't do it, even though the Wright brothers had already done it. It was like 4 years later before anybody recognized, oh, he was wrong. And, you know, that kind of thing can put a kink in space exploration that lasts for years and years. Oh, another thing would be the space shuttle accidents. They had an accident, and, you know, it's 2 or 3 years. And even though the solutions are rather obvious, you know, it puts a hold on everything.
Well, that of course, was government money. So we're talking about private money, if it would be treated any differently.
I don't. It would be very similarly, but... And it might be slightly faster, but I don't think it would, you know, like it was 4 months between two SpaceX launches. You know, okay, they fixed the problem. It really was a minor engineering. It was harder to figure out what the error was than it was to fix it. Elon can move forward as long as there isn't people. Once there's people involved, the news media jumps in, and then it gets messy real quick.
What else, Marshall? Or are you exhausted out on the topic?
No. I could go on for days, but it's time to let somebody else talk.
All right. I appreciate your call. Thank you for checking in with us.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. So, listeners, our toll-free number is available, as is email, drspace@thespaceshow.com. The toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. I have a cartoon from Adrian in San Diego, and I really don't know how to present this cartoon on air. And he didn't tell me who the cartoon is by or what the date is or where anybody could find it. So I guess I'm just going to acknowledge that Adrian sent a cartoon. And Adrian, if you can tell me what you took the cartoon from or where it is, I can direct people to go find it. But I don't honestly think I could describe it adequately, you know, where it would work if I tried to sort of give a narrative of what the cartoon was. But it did bring a smile to my face. So thank you, Adrian, for sending that in. Jerry, we have another caller on hold. But Jerry in Merritt Island, Florida. I was wondering how long it would take Jerry to respond to the Wall Street Journal articles, stuff that I talked about, because Jerry is probably maybe our biggest SpaceX supporter and advocate and fan and believer. So here's his note, and I think it's well stated, but I also have the Wall Street Journal data, and it's, you can forget the Wall Street Journal conclusions. You can look at the data yourself and come up with your own conclusions. That's what's nice about having the actual data. Don't doubt that SpaceX finances don't show much on the return yet on reusability, but I would caution the reader of Wall Street Journal articles on SpaceX to take their conclusions with a grain of salt. So again, Jerry, I don't know that if you're looking at the articles or not, but there's one thing to look at Wall Street Journal conclusions by Andy and the other author. There's another thing to look at the actual data and make your own conclusions. Two different things, especially if you know your way around financial information. The Wall Street Journal and much of legacy journalism are already biased against anything that Musk does. What Elon is doing in energy and space is a threat to incumbent interest in big oil, autos, and aerospace. It would be naive to think that those interests don't pay for media support. One should note that the CFO of SpaceX did respond by noting that SpaceX has $1 billion in the bank and no debt, with 70 launches on the manifest. SpaceX is anticipating as many as 27 launches in 2017. That is more than any nation state launched in 2016. And, well, Jerry, I hope they do it, and we'll see in December of 2017 what percentage of 27 they actually made. Okay? Let's see, there was a... Okay, there's another message, an email message from Marcio. So this is a gentleman who called when Bill Rowe was on the phone, and he wants to call back about a website or some kind of concept that he has. I've looked at it quite a while ago. I don't remember much about it. Called, and I guess you can Google this if you want to see what he's talking about, Engine of Levitation. So engine is just engine, E-N-G-I-N-E, of levitation, L-E-V-I-T-A-T-I-O-N. And he wants to call in and promote the engine of levitation. So assuming he calls in, then some of you may want to check that out. And if you want to... comment on what he is talking about or what he puts on his website, you can do so by email. And if you really feel compelled to talk to him, I can give you another number to use to call in. But I haven't been to his website in a couple of months, so I don't remember much about it. But if he wants to call in to talk about it, that's fine. And then I have another email question. It actually has something to do with what I just talked about in response to Jerry, and maybe Jerry would be a better person to answer it than me. Susan is in Portland, and Susan says Musk has an ambitious launch schedule for 2017. He's not come anything close to such an ambitious launch schedule. Do you think he will actually make it? So we're talking about approximately 27 launches for 2017. So that's at least 2+ a month. Will he make it? I doubt it. But it's not impossible. Will he have more launches in 2016? Probably, because remember the accident had them stand down from the summer through until yesterday. So they didn't have launches the second half of the year. So I think for sure, barring any unfortunate disaster or something, that he will do better than last year. I'd like to see him do 27 launches. Time will tell. I have no crystal ball on it, but I think it's a hard and ambitious goal. I think we do have another caller on hold. And caller, welcome to the Space Show. Who are you, please?
Hi, David. This is John in Fremont.
Hi, John. So you're the source of my Wall Street Journal articles that Jerry seems to have taken issue with in some sense.
Yeah, I was really surprised to see the 10% savings on reusability. But, you know, after thinking about it, he hasn't demonstrated, Musk has not, and SpaceX have not demonstrated this yet, not even once. And you know, it's going to take a while to get the processes down for refurbishing these first stages, and you know, I think it's cautious, 10%, but you know, SpaceX is a world class leader in you know, taking the cost out of manufacturing and reducing launch costs. So, you know, I wouldn't bet against them, but it may take a while.
Well, and the other thing is there's no real reality-based information on how many times a reused second stage can be flown. And as it is flown more and more times, do you have to reduce some of the stresses and capabilities on it, like mass and speed and other kinds of issues, in order to not overtax the structure? So that will, depending on the life expectancy and the parameters of getting that life expectancy, that will also adjust, you know, what that cost reduction number is. So, you know, if you can fly it three times, that's one thing. If you can fly it 50 times, that's another thing. So there is no hard and fast evidence on that. There's only conjecture right now, you know, based on good analysis and all of that. But, you know, they need to actually demo it and you know, fly it a couple of times and, you know, do all the kind of hard testing, and they need to see what actually happens in use. And they're not there yet. So that 10% number will change. It could actually change in both directions.
Yes. Do you know, I can't remember, was the Falcon 9 from the start designed for reusability, or did they tack that on as, you know, a secondary feature after they designed the original rocket?
No, it's they've always touted and said that they've designed their systems for human spaceflight and for reusability. And in fact, the last time Gwen was on the show and she was being asked about reusable penalties, because you have to add mass to the rocket for reusability that you don't have if you're throwing it away. Plus you have to have additional fuel on board, or you can't use all your fuel. However you want to deal with that, and then you need, you know, landing legs, or however they're going to do the landing, and the rocket is more robust. So she was being asked about a reusable penalty, and she kept saying that it's all built in, there is no reusable penalty, it's all built into it. But then later that year they launched some heavy SES, I think it was SES satellites to GEO, and they used a stripped down version of the Falcon 9 for launch that did not have any of the reusable features on it, because they needed more oomph to get the satellites into orbit. So clearly there's a Falcon 9 reusable penalty, because if there wasn't one, they wouldn't have needed to launch a special stripped down version of it. But I do think it's been designed from either the start or very early on for reusability as well as human spaceflight. So, and that's part of how they have managed to control manufacturing cost and other things, by building all this in from the scratch, and then they don't have to do it as add-ons, which always cost more down the road with their project.
Yeah. Okay, well, it's...
I mean, maybe someone listening... will correct me a little bit on that, but I think that they've always had these targets in mind with his company from day one. I see Jerry's already got another email up that I haven't read yet, but he would be also a very good authority on the fact that they're designing for humans and reusability. Go back to the very beginning of the companies. I remember really early interviews with Elon and then with Gwen, and they always talked about having these capabilities built in from the scratch, even if they weren't going to use them right away.
Okay. Well, good to know. Thank you.
What did you think of the other parts? Because there were other parts to the financial story, like the vast majority of SpaceX revenue comes from satellites. Their launch services business doesn't produce very much of their revenue at all. Did you notice those charts and graphs on the percentage of launch service revenue versus satellite launch revenue?
Yeah, I didn't look at it in that much detail, so I don't really think I can comment on it.
Well, you ought to go back. I mean, that is really incredible information that Andy Pastor got on the finances of SpaceX and how their income is derived and things of that nature. There's a lot of really interesting categories. It's like looking at a really detailed, composite, comprehensive financial statement. So
I am surprised that they got that information from a private company. It's pretty amazing.
I am too. He doesn't tell you how he got it. SpaceX just simply said no comment, which is to be expected. I don't think I would comment either. but I also do think the Wall Street Journal would not have put it out there if they didn't have some way of doing some due diligence check to verify it.
Yeah.
All right, John. Again, thank you for sending me the information. I really appreciate it. And listeners, I know it's hard to get Wall Street Journal articles because if you're not a subscriber, but I think you can often just search on Google for the headlines that I gave you, and you can actually access the article and bypass the Wall Street Journal restrictions on being a subscriber.
Yeah, I think they allow that for a few days, maybe a week, and then it's restricted.
And then it gets restricted again.
Glad to help out. And
all right, and I don't subscribe to the Journal, so please, when you see other articles coming in about interesting space stuff by Andy or others, please send them to me. I'd love to have those articles, but I'm not a subscriber to the Journal.
No problem.
Thanks again,
David.
Thanks, John.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. So, listeners, the line is available, and it is 1-866-687-7223. And I've got two emails from Jerry, so let me read the first one first. What's he saying? So he gives me a link. I guess I can put it in the summary. It's too big to give on air. This is an artificial gravity calculator. So he says this is... phone's ringing. All right, this is spin calc, a down and dirty way to see how much rotation you would need, you would have to have to simulate various gravities on a long duration space trip. And the answer is for the ITS BFR, that's the big SpaceX rocket, is a rotation of 3.2 RPM given a center gravity 17 meters from the aft of the ship, well within the toleration of the average human. Another factor to the length of time one spends in low gravity, Musk's presentation gave a transit time of 90 to 150 days given his high velocity trajectories, which, by the way, are questionable in the minds of people who do orbital trajectories all the time. So I just throw that out there. This is... It may or may not be plausible, or it may be really pushing the edge. And then he goes on to say, additionally, since when do we stop exploitation of new environments because of the harmful effects it may have on humans? How many seamen were heaved overboard before they found out that the citrus fruit would prevent scurvy? How many European cities were devastated by plague because of, you know, coming into Black Sea ports from trade with the East. We do what we have to do and count the human cost later. Jerry, I don't, while you may be right, and I'm not in the least bit interested in having that argument, in 2017, it is not the same as when sailors started sailing the ocean hundreds of years ago. And the threshold for risk and for people losing their lives doing this or that is a lot different than what it was before. And I believe that it is really naive to make the kind of comparisons you're making for today. So, frankly, you could have Congress say, we're not going to risk lives like this and have these companies doing this to people, and we just won't issue launch licenses. And if you don't think that that's a possibility, well, fine. You don't have to think that's a possibility. I think that is a possibility, unless somehow we become a more risk-oriented culture. And right now the trends are that we're more and more risk-averse. Look, college students don't even want to hear offensive language. That's too much for them to take. You can just go down the road and point to the trends that are happening in society to take us away from doing things that are risky. So while I think people ought to be able to take whatever risk they want and suffer the consequences, although sometimes those consequences have social impact on the rest of us, like we might, you know, have insurance premiums go up if people recklessly kill themselves doing crazy things, and life insurance companies or something have to pay, or medical costs might go up to treat people doing crazy kinds of things or highly risky things. So there could be increased social costs for people. But for the most part, I think people ought to be allowed to take whatever risk they want and make whatever decisions they want. And if they've got other people close to them in their life that it may impact, like family members, children, parents, employers, stuff like that, then work those problems out with those people that are impacted directly. I remember talking years ago to one of the adventure travel companies, and we were talking about doing great white shark diving off the San Francisco Bay at the Farallon Islands, and I was told that a lot of people who would like to do that trip and go in the steel cage and do all of that and have the great whites come in and, you know, chum the water around the cage and take the pictures and see them up close and all of that are not allowed to do that by the companies that they work for. So they can ride on the boat out to the Farallon Islands as long as the boat is Coast Guard okay and has Coast Guard approved life preservers and emergency devices on board, but a lot of the people who wanted to go down and have the great white experience were not permitted because their companies wouldn't allow them to take those risks. Well, I think that's the way it should be. I don't believe the government needs to tell us whether we can take the risk or not. But again, if your family says don't do it, I think that's appropriate. If you're a key member of a company and, you know, they say don't do it or the board says don't do it, I think that company has every right to make that requirement on you. And if you don't like it, quit the company. So I, in a way, tend to agree with Jerry, but I just don't see any hint that we're going in a different direction than one of being more and more risk averse. So Jerry sent in, and I got a caller on hold, so I should take that call. But he sent in another email that said SpaceX is trying to build the boat on the way across the river. The use of densified propellants is an experimental process that is being conducted on operation flights. One of the reasons SpaceX can't charge more for flights. Now that they have gone back to a less challenging and less capable second stage architecture, they may well have a chance to launch 27 flights in 12 months. I would say that they are pacing themselves as to how fast they can get pad 40 back up and running. Well, time will tell. I don't think they have a track record to support 27 launches, but hopefully they can do that. They have a lot of delays, and we'll see. And if they can get 27 launches up, great for the company and great for commercial space. Okay, let's see who's actually calling us. I've made the caller wait long enough. Hi, caller. Welcome to the program. Who are you and where are you, please?
This is John in Fort Worth.
Hi, John.
Yeah. Well, on the SpaceX reusability thing, I guess, they quote a price for a launch, which is, what, something around $70 million?
Something like that. I don't have it in front of me.
60, well, let's just say 70. It's that range. Now, what I'm saying is there's a lot goes into a launch, but I mean, it isn't all just that lovely two-stage rocket. It's also the use of the launch facility, range of propellants, servicing, people to prepare it, you know, ground crew, people to get it ready to go and all that, right?
Well, yeah, that's their complete package, which includes getting the rocket off the ground, which includes everything that you're talking about.
Right. So you have to back out of there just to cost the rocket to see what reusability would do, and then look at, I guess, the first stage itself, right, which I think in terms of the rocket itself is a lot more than 10%. It must be, I mean, 9 engines versus 1, and the engines and fuel pumps and that part of it's a big part of the cost, plus you have proportional, you know, I think percentage-wise, just because of economy of scale, the second stage is going to be a little bit more costly or per pound than the first stage, just using the economy of scale rates. But still, I mean, the bulk of the rocket cost is going to be that first stage, so it comes back into what has to be done to recover the first stage to make it usable to launch again, and that's why I guess we don't know just exactly how much work is involved in that. I mean,
well, I don't think those kinds of detailed accounting numbers have ever been released.
Right.
And the truth is, I don't know that SpaceX is ready to release them because they probably don't have a good handle on it yet. They've done so few of them. They've not flown any of them. And the life expectancy of the refurbished first stage is going to play a role in the overall cost pricing and savings. And what do you have to do to refurbish it after the second, third, and fourth launch? Do your refurbishing costs escalate after each use of the rocket because you have to put that in? And this data is simply not known as far as I know. I've never seen anything that attempts to show this kind of cost analysis, refurbishing costs, and therefore you can extrapolate some savings out of it. You know, maybe you save more using the reused rocket the first time, and maybe each time that it flies, you save less because your, you know, refurbishing costs might go up. And then at some point where the lines meet, you don't want to refurbish the damn thing anymore because it's not cost effective. And we don't know what that crossover point would be.
And they probably don't yet know either.
I would assume so because they haven't flown it yet.
It's going to have to be an experiment. It's like they say, it's an experiment. We're actually doing development as we're actually launching here, so we're looking at...
It's an experiment in process.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's a hopeful one, but what I'm getting at is if, depending on what the numbers are, I mean, we know from the space shuttle world there was substantial turnaround cost per flight.
Yeah, but the SpaceX rockets are designed so totally different, it's not even funny.
Well, I'm not trying to say it is. I'm just saying we know historically that it can be pretty massive.
Yeah,
but I'm assuming in this case it isn't. I mean, but
I would assume that too, but it may still end up being only marginally cost effective, especially the more times you fly it.
Right. And we don't know how. Well, that's the whole thing. Is
we just don't know.
I guess they would have some ideas about this ground engine test.
So
a big part of it's going to be the propulsion system, I assume.
One of the things I'd like to see, and I don't think that it exists, but maybe Jerry can answer it since he follows SpaceX like he does his heart rate. Of the 27 launches that are proposed for 2017, how many of those are intended to fly a rebuilt, refurbished first stage? Are we talking about 27 brand-new first-stage launches every single time, or are we saying 10 of those 27 will fly a refurbished first stage? And then if they're going to fly a refurbished one, how many refurbished first stages will fly two times, and how many will fly three times? So that's the kind of financial and statistical analysis that I would like to look at to get a real handle on these questions. But honest to God, I don't think the information exists at this point.
I don't even think they know.
Probably
I mean,
not.
What they're going to find
well,
out
well, they may,
to do it.
They may know how many of the 27 launches they would like to aim for to use a refurbished first stage. They may know that. They may
right.
know how many of their customers are willing to fly a refurbished first stage.
I would think there'd be a higher insurance cost on those, at least initially.
Well, with that, I don't know either.
Well, if you're the insurance company, just put you, imagine you're the insurance company.
Well, I would do it because it'd give me a chance to make more money, even if the risk wasn't there.
Yeah, but you'd charge a higher premium.
Yeah, of course, I'd make more money. But
I'm saying it can't be insured. I'm saying it will cost more.
Yeah, I think it will. But, you know, it gives the insurance companies, whether deservedly or not, a chance to rate to you know, bill and invoice a bigger premium. But maybe it's deserved. I don't know. Maybe the insurance companies feel that this is all so new and so unknown. The risk is much higher. Therefore, we need a much higher premium. Or maybe they just see it as a cash cow. I don't know the answer to that.
Well, but I'm just thinking that if you're talking at 10%, I mean, the insurance... If you have, if you're launching what a half a billion dollar satellite or something, right? It's a hypothetical. Is that a reasonable number to be typical? I don't know. 100, whatever it is, 200 million. You know, I mean, the question then you get into is if you're saving 10% on the launch cost, which is let's say 7 million, would the premium not go up enough that you see what I mean? That it would almost negate the advantage of using the cheaper rocket.
Well.
If you're only going to get a 10% discount.
There's a lot of information that needs to be known. And
I'm just saying these are interesting, you know, analyses. However, let's say you could get the point where the rocket is, I don't know, it would require some thorough inspection, I assume, but effectively you could turn them around with not too great of you know, maintenance costs between launches. And you could say you typically have an average 10 flight use before it has to be scrapped. That would start being a big cost reduction if it got to that level, I think.
Well, maybe, but again, all that information isn't there yet, and whether SpaceX has it or not, your guess is as good as mine. But, you know, everybody's focusing on what I said about the reusable stuff, but the finances on the company are really... really interesting, because if they've got graphs and charts on revenue versus operating income, and then you know, how the company has gone up and then gone down, and how they're projecting, you know, lesser amounts in the coming years for launch pad services. I mean you really, for people who are, you know, really glued to SpaceX and they love it, and, you know, like most of our listeners, and you're really interested in this stuff, I would urge you to really go through and see this one article from January 13th. It is the more detailed of the two. And again, the headline is "Exclusive Peek at SpaceX Data Shows Loss in 2015, Heavy Expectations for Nascent Internet Service. Internal documents reveal aerospace company has thin bottom line, vulnerable to accidents. Hopes planned satellite internet business will finance eventual Mars missions." And look at the breakdown of and the finances of SpaceX. And I guess we can assume it's correct. I mean, I don't really know for sure that it is, but there's a lot of really good information in this article from January 13th, and the information that's in it is much more accurate and revealing than the statement about reusability, which is only a statement. There is no quantitative backup documentation supporting the statement on reusability. The graphs and charts are all referenced and cited.
I would also think that to some degree you wouldn't want to necessarily give the full amount of savings due to reusability if you could get by with it, because that'd be a way to increase your profit margin, somebody else had a competitive reusable system forcing your prices down. You're the cheapest guy out there, so why not use that as a chance to exploit the profitability?
Well,
if I could get people to accept 10% off and would take the deal, which I'm not sure if you could, but if you could, then all of a sudden it becomes kind of interesting, right? That you could maybe, you're actually doing it for 20% less, and that's more profit.
Well, I just would like to see real data.
Oh, sure.
Come through. But again, I draw people who are interested in SpaceX finances to the first article, because it does give you graphs and charts and quantitative data, and it references that data. So you get a much better financial view of SpaceX operations, revenue streams, and things like that, plus projections into the future, because they've got projections into 2020. And it's pretty interesting. So, if you're one of those who's interested in looking at financials and you're interested in those of SpaceX, this is probably the best we're going to see, given that it's a private company.
Yeah, it's excellent. Well, the other thing that's kind of interesting with the Dr. Rowe segment that led us off, I'm always kind of struck on the space show is we live in different kind of worlds here in the space community, a bit of almost, silos of thinking. On the one hand, we've got SpaceX thinking, which we're going to go to Mars and we're going to do it fairly quick and it's going to be a lot of people. And then we got the other extreme, can humans even be healthy enough to survive the trip and live there? It's kind of an amazing world of,
Dr. Rowe is a real stickler for his research, and often NASA cringes with his research. But I have known Bill for, I don't know, 10 years. I just spent a good evening with him when he was presenting at a medical conference that was in San Francisco, near the San Francisco airport. I think it was late November or something like that. I have known Bill to be really honest. He is very good at what he does. I think he is probably excessively cautionary, and I do know that he does research into areas and looks at things very differently than a traditional aerospace medicine doctor. But I just because of all of that, and because NASA cringes with Bill Rowe, I would not discount what Bill says. I don't think there's enough quantitative data to support Bill's conclusions. And he has very, very small sample sizes. So when you read an article about there's this latest Harvard study with Queens College of Timbuktu, and they looked at 7,000 people on type 2 diabetes and eating bananas to see what the effect was. There haven't been 7,000 people that have flown to space. So, but Bill's sample size is like one or two or three. I mean, how many moonwalkers were there, and then how many moonwalkers were there that had cardiovascular issues? So that's basically the sample size. So he can't get any information on the space shuttle astronauts because NASA doesn't release it. And that's, I don't think he's ever tried to get any cosmonaut information. I don't know for that for a fact. He may have attempted to get cosmonaut information in the past, but I don't think he has. So for his conclusions and his analysis, he deals with a very tiny sample size. And I think when you make conclusions with a really tiny sample size, you've got a lot of risk in there. So SpaceX making conclusions on reusability also has a very tiny sample size. You know, how many orbital reused first stages have flown in space? So, I mean, that's a non-existent sample size.
Well, on the other hand, they did do their grasshopper experiments on landing, which...
Well, yeah, but we're talking about...
And I think, again, ground testing of the engines might give you a lot of useful data. I mean, if you know how many cycles the engine can take.
But,
you know,
but look, if you want to see how that refurbished thing is going to hold up from launch, max Q, going to orbit, turning around at supersonic speeds, coming back, retro-landing, you know, the whole kit and caboodle, you need to fly the second stage and see how they do it. And testing this or that on Earth or doing this or that with Grasshopper out in Texas is not going to cut it. Grasshopper doesn't go to max Q with a payload on top of it.
No, I'm going to say, but the other issue is the engine. I mean, I think that probably there's two issues. The structure and the engine are the two biggies, right?
Yeah, but you've got
to... The engine can be tested on the ground to the full cycle.
But not with the masses and the stress of the launch and everything. You got to fly the whole thing.
Affects the engine itself much.
Well,
the mounts?
Well, you might. It might. You don't know. You've got to look at it. And when you have zero sample size,
the key issue is, can the engines themselves take?
Well, they can on the ground, but you don't know what they're going to do in flight you just got to fly them and see.
Well, I agree.
See what they do.
Them. I think they may have a lot of theoretical data that gives them a pretty good projection.
I mean,
we design a lot of things, and if the theoretical projections are completely wrong, you have multi-billion-dollar project after project just simply failing. You know, and that doesn't usually happen. I mean, they have problems, but they don't usually just, it's a disaster,
well,
you know.
Here, Jerry sent in a note on this and said SpaceX has not said and probably doesn't even know how many of the 27 flights they will use will be refurbished first stages. They have said one refurbished stage will fly soon, and less well known is that one of the boosters on the first Falcon Heavy will be a refurbished booster. But, of course, none of this is flying. So, again, they have a zero sample size of having flown a first stage. Bezos has got a better sample size than SpaceX does on his rocket. One thing that is not often noted is that SpaceX will need a lot of rockets for its constellation and communication satellites. They are lucky to know someone with a lot of rockets to use. So I think this is all going to be information that is forthcoming as they begin to fly reusable boosters. And, maybe we'll see some of that in 2017. But I honestly think data collection and understanding all of this and working out the economics is probably 2 to 3 years away.
Yeah. I don't disagree. The experiment continues.
Yeah, but thank God they're doing it and that they're committed to doing it. I think that's really important.
Well, the fact they've actually done this is impressive itself. Nobody else has.
Other than Blue, but they're suborbital. So, yeah, you're right.
So it'll be interesting to see what happens. Well, so what do you think of that mirror thing, huh?
Well, I don't know. I mean, the mirror is a little bit like the National Enquirer, so...
But it's really based on a Secure Team 10 video, and that's a known thing on YouTube. UFO group, so it is what it is.
It is what it is, so I'm not jumping up and
down. Blame the mirror for it one way or the other, other than they gave it publicity, but it's...
I'm not jumping up and down saying E.T. has been confirmed by astronauts on the ISS.
I couldn't make enough out to tell anything, frankly.
Well, I never can.
I looked at it two or three times, and there's a little glitter, there's a little glimmer over here, and there's a little glimmer over there.
So it would be nice to interview the station astronauts who took the video and see if they would talk freely about it, but I know from my experience with doing interviews with active duty astronauts with NASA, they don't talk freely about anything. So forget
especially about this subject.
Well, that and sex in space, they don't talk about that either.
That's also a controversial subject.
That's
either
right.
Either yay or nay, either they won't talk about it because it's complete nonsense and embarrassing, or they won't talk about it because they're told not to talk about it. But in either event, they're not going to talk about it.
About either one of these topics. So yeah. It just leaves it all up to fun and games and speculation. So.
Yeah. Oh, well, it was. Thanks for the email, Ian.
And, again, if somebody out there knows more about the UK press than I do, and maybe the Mirror is higher quality than the National Enquirer. I don't know. I know that the gossip rags and sensational things in the UK are plentiful, and they have a different standing in society than our garbage does here. So, but maybe
this isn't unique. I mean, I've seen other Secure Team 10 and other videos of the same sort, where something looks like, I've seen higher quality than this, where something looks like it's moving around and ways that aren't orbital, you know what I mean? And
can you tell if the video is fake?
Well, no, I don't think. I mean, it's actually, I think it's an actual video that's released from NASA. I don't think that's the issue.
Well, could they have faked it? I mean, could they
alter it? I guess they could
have,
but NASA could call them on that and say you faked the video. I don't think they're claiming that. You know, I don't think that. The issue is more with the ones where you really see the object and you can really see it with definition.
Yeah.
That's the one where people tend to say it's faked.
And you see the windows with the ET waving at you as they go by or giving you the middle finger or something like that.
Well, this is an object that's clearly definable what it is, you know, like the triangular UFO thing I sent you that time. That's clearly definable, but here we have something that's out there. But I think NASA would say something like more, that's probably just some kind of you know,
artifact.
Fluid in space, a bubble or a piece of debris or, you know.
True.
Reflected on.
I
think that's the way the answer to these things is more like it. Because there have been other cases like this where somebody called it something like this, and I think they had a response like it was just something, you know, normal explanation, debris or something, you know, I mean, that kind of thing, reflecting off the sunlight or whatever.
All right, listen, some people want to call in. Anything else?
I think that'll be it for today.
John, thank you for your call.
Okay.
Bye-bye. Okay, listeners, those of you who have been emailing me wondering why the line is busy all the time, well, that's because a lot of different people have been calling the show today. So if you want to get a call in, the line is available right now. There is still time, 1-866-687-7223, and we will hopefully get some more phone calls. So Adrian sent me the link to the cartoon, and I will put it in the archive summary, so that you all can go to the link and see the cartoon that he sent me. The line is ringing. Let's see who it is. Good afternoon, caller. Welcome to the Space Show. Who are you? Where are you?
This is Doug from Southern California.
Hi, Doug.
Hi. I just wanted to draw the attention of the listeners to something that I have posted on the Internet about what I call META, M-E-T-A, Most Efficient Transportation Architecture. And it's sort of like a near-term concept for how we can inexpensively send cargo to the moon and Mars, as well as crew to the moon and Mars. And I'd like to invite people to go ahead and take a look at it and give me some feedback. And it is at a website, lunarcock.com/META, M-E-T-A. And basically the concept is using the lowest cost launchers to low Earth orbit for cargo. And then from there, using ion propulsion, solar electric propulsion, to low lunar orbit and low Mars orbit. And then from there, using refuelable or reusable landers from the moon and from Mars, so that you can be able to reduce the amount of mass that you have to launch from Earth in terms of propellant. And then for crew, you got to push people through the Van Allen radiation belt, so you can't drop them off in a low Earth orbit. You push them all the way to an EML staging point like EML-1. And then for the moon, you have the refuelable lander go up to, not to low lunar orbit now, but now to EML-1. And then dock with a crew module and bring them down to the lunar surface. But for Mars, it's different. There's also the Mars Ferry, but for interplanetary travel, I think you'd need to have a craft that's specifically designed for interplanetary transport, and it stays up in space. It doesn't actually come down to, you know, either Mars or Earth. If people, again, if they go to lunarcost.com/mecca, then I'd appreciate it if they would give me some feedback.
I'm at your page now. Is there a feedback link on it, or through the Space Show blog you want feedback?
You know, actually, if people could email me, is there an email address at the very bottom?
No, I don't see it.
Okay, I'll go ahead and put that up within the hour there. But it's dougspace007@gmail.com. So dougspace007@gmail.com.
That's one way. And, of course, listeners, if you do post a comment on the blog, I'll make sure Doug sees it.
I'll be looking at the comments. People can comment on the blog as well.
It says next topic. Are you planning to be doing regular topics on this site?
So this would be one page. So the transportation architecture would be one page for a new group that I'm developing called the Space Development Group. But there would be other topics as well. So this is not really ready for prime time. If you click on the upper left-hand little menu icon of the page.
Okay, I'm going there. Okay.
So then there's a pretty extensive menu of different topics.
Okay,
is that right?
So, well, I can't read it. It's all in HTML. So, I'd have to figure out how to take it out of HTML to read it.
But yeah, no, that's...
If you said
what browser?
Internet Explorer 11.
Yeah, I'm having problems with that, so I need to figure out what's going on there.
Well, you should, the best thing that I can come up with is to bypass the bastards and go to Chrome or Firefox or Safari, because you know Windows, Microsoft is putting their resources into their new browser that comes with Windows 10 and higher. But if you're still using Windows 7 or one of the older formats, you're stuck with Internet Explorer 11, and they don't really support it much anymore. And I'm noticing more and more things don't work with it.
Yeah, enough people use Internet Explorer. I need to figure out how to make sure that browser can view it properly.
Yeah, well, I'm just noticing more and more difficulties using Internet Explorer.
Yeah.
Very frustrating.
Yeah, me too.
But they want to drive you to Windows 10 or their newer system, and many of us don't want to go there.
Just on the previous topic about SpaceX, I know that when he presented, I think it was in Monterey that he presented about his, interplanetary transport system concept, you know, there's a whole lot of people back then who were asking this apparently rhetorical, unanswerable question of, well, how is he going to pay for it? You know, great technology, but he didn't say anything about paying for it. Well, he actually did in the presentation. But also prior to that, he had mentioned about when he was getting in Seattle, I think it was, this company to launch the satellites. He explicitly stated that, you know, the satellite business is what's going to go ahead and pay for transportation to Mars. And these documents are indicating that he continues to pursue, you know, to pursue that path. So we need to bear in mind, I think he's estimated the development of the BFR would be about $10 billion. And I think he has right about that amount of personal wealth. And so I think we need to be open-minded about the financial side of developing the transport system. I think between his personal wealth as well as being able to launch phenomenal numbers of satellites, 4,000 satellites is what I think was listed, using reusable, you know, launchers, and if and if they you just launch until they explode, you know, you just get the maximum use out of it. You know, I think that it could be a fairly inexpensive way of launching a constellation. And then the key thing is that when launching companies launch up satellites, the launching companies do not gain the revenue from the satellites. You know, whoever launched the DirecTV satellites, not the launchers that get the monthly payments from the users. It's the company that owns the satellite. And so I think Elon is figuring that not only could he launch these things for relatively low cost, but SpaceX could actually become sort of the next Time Warner or whatever. DirecTV is maybe a better an example. And then they would be able to get these monthly revenues from consumers. And that could significantly improve, you know, the revenue stream.
Well, a lot of unanswered questions there.
Yeah, but we have some concepts. We don't need to be completely blank about what the path, you know, what SpaceX is looking at for the path for being able to pay for it. It's been very clear. And
he said in Mexico that it was paying for going to Mars was way beyond his capability and that of SpaceX, and he wanted to see if there weren't ways to do things with NASA and even foreign entities to join in to paying for this. He was even willing to make hardware at NASA centers to help get NASA to pay for some of the cost. So he's very clear about that, Doug.
I don't think that's actually correct. If you recall correctly, when you put up on the screen about how to pay for this, you had the joke, you know, the underwear pants sort of thing. But Kickstarter, you know, those were two jokings. But the two things that he had in between was launching of satellites. I forget what the other one was. And that is not only launching other people's satellites like he's doing, getting revenue from that, but also the satellite constellation. I think that fits within that category. I think he did make mention that he thought that a public-private partnership would be the best way to go. I don't recall him mentioning anything about international. I don't remember that specifically.
It wasn't a big part of it, but he said that would be fine if they could, you know, come in on parts of the project or whatever and pay for it. I think he's reluctant on international in terms of who's running the show and that type of thing. But he said he was looking for massive amounts of funding and that was basically undecided at the time that he actually gave the Mexican talk. But he was looking at all sorts of things. And I know we, even on the space show, people who were there talked about his willingness, so it seemed, which was kind of weird, to think that he would have hardware made at NASA centers in order to sort of help get NASA on board.
So, no, let's not misunderstand that. He talked about using the Michoud facility, and a lot of people are saying, oh, that means having the workers at Michoud build this VFR. That's not what he said. It's like he's using Launch Complex 39A, I think it is. That doesn't mean that it's NASA employees that are running that complex. No, SpaceX is using that facility, and they're having their own people working on that.
So you think SpaceX is going to rent or lease floor space from Michoud, staff it with their own people, and pay Michoud some sort of a turnkey thing to use their utilities and their hardware and their resources, but it's all SpaceX employees. That's what you think Musk meant when he made that kind of a comment.
Yes.
Okay.
Just like they're doing at the launch complex.
Okay, so that isn't what got picked up in Reddit, and that was a 60-page interview with Musk that I think I mentioned on the space show, but I never put the footnotes of reference because we never really talked about it very much. And it isn't what was said by a lot of others. He was talking about getting NASA on board to help make things for and using NASA people so that they would have a commitment into this Mars program. And there was a lot of criticism because they said, how in the hell is Musk going to pull that one off? Because NASA has their own roadmap to Mars, whether you believe it's real or not. They do have some sort of a roadmap to Mars with a different timetable than Musk has. So why would they commit resources to help Musk do his Mars plan when it would fly directly into the competitive face of what NASA is saying they have in terms of a Mars plan? Because the two ideas are not in harmony with one another. So here's the deal. Nobody knows any of this thing for sure because none of it's happening. But I don't understand. I mean, maybe he could rent space from Michoud, but I don't know. If NASA is really serious about their roadmap to Mars, and I have no idea if they are or not, but it is not anything like Musk's roadmap to Mars, why would NASA commit resources and facilities to help Musk accomplish his mission, which would fly in the face and be probably much better than anything NASA's doing? That would be self-destructive from the public sector's perspective. But again, this is so tentative, and who knows what's real or not real. I mean, we're just sitting here blowing out ideas about statements that were made at a big conference in Mexico, and who knows what the reality will be 10 years from today or 8 years from today. I just don't know. Go ahead.
So my answer to your questions would be that NASA is trying in many different ways to do public-private programs. I mean, we can spend probably 20 minutes talking about all their public-private programs. They want the commercial space sector to be developed and including using their facilities. And there's plenty of different examples of this. So I do agree that these visions are, you know, it's basically if SpaceX succeeds, there's really no need for the NASA program. But if NASA sees itself as succeeding through its own efforts as well as through the efforts of the, partnering with commercial companies, which I think there's just so much, you know, NASA is very, very involved in helping commercial companies move forward. Basically it would come down to question would, if SpaceX wanted to go ahead and use the Michoud facilities, if there is enough space, whatnot, for them to be able to do that, would NASA, for only political reasons, deny that contract? And I don't think so.
Well, one will have to wait and see as to whether your analysis passes the test of time in reality, because I have no way. Here, Jerry is pontificating again. Let's see. Maybe he has a comment, because he's my SpaceX
guru. Let's be careful to read and listen to what Elon actually said rather than interpreting, putting words into his mouth. I think a lot of the latter has been done.
Okay, so Jerry's not really agreeing with you either, but he says the composite tank work is being done by a contractor, not SpaceX. SpaceX is looking at Michoud because the production of many tanks will require a large facility and a large workforce familiar with composite work. Why build your own when you could lease an existing facility from NASA? It's way too early to know what's going to happen with that and the workforce. So, I don't know who contracts Michoud to make their tanks either. I don't have that information. But, yeah, I think the bottom line is all of this is just so early, and, you know, it's so far off in the future. I just hope I'm around to see it all, but it's going to be a long, long time.
Well, who built the composite tank that Elon showed as a presentation?
I don't know. He may have built that as a thing in his own factory there in Hawthorne to show as an example. But I'm just reading Jerry's thing, and SpaceX likes to do vertical construction, so they like to control all of their manufacturing in-house. So whether they want to go outside for composite work or not, Jerry seems to think that that's what they might do, but I don't know.
So the picture that Elon Musk showed of the composite tank had the SpaceX team in the picture, as the ones who built the tank. So they have, SpaceX has the ability to produce very large composite tanks.
Well, I'll tell you what, I'm going to send you Jerry's email, and you can correspond with Jerry on it. This is too ridiculous to continue talking about on the space show. Jerry is the one who's talking about contracting this out at Michu, not me. I don't have any information on it. I don't know the first thing about it. So here, the email is on the way. You can correspond directly with Jerry if you want to, because he seems to follow SpaceX closer than anybody else and seems to always have current information about SpaceX that nobody else has. So communicate with Jerry on it. I don't. This is a subject I don't know anything about, but it's too. It's so far out there, Doug, and it's too minuscule of a thing to start spending a lot of time talking about. We have no information.
I look forward to the email.
I've already sent it. And if you do,
okay,
if you do communicate, and Jerry, you too, if you guys communicate, please copy me on it, because I don't know much about the topic, and I would like to learn. And as I said, Jerry supplies me with a lot of information on SpaceX that I don't get from anyone else, and I would like to be in the loop on this. So please send it to me.
Thanks, David.
Or have I worn you out?
That's fine. I'm done.
You're done. I will make sure that everybody has that link to your website. And make, if you do add additional pages to it, make sure we know so we can keep telling people to keep checking it.
Will do. Thank you, David.
All right. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
Okay, listeners. Let's see if anybody else wants to call. And, Jerry, if you do communicate with Doug, because I did send him your note on the tanks, copy me on it. Again, I want to learn, and I want to stay in the loop, because this is not something I know very much about. You know, when I was doing shows with Jim Wirtz, and I've been trying to get Jim back on the show, he was making composite tanks and wrapping them, and he really knew a lot about it. I don't think he's done anything for SpaceX, but this is Microcosm. But if I can get Jim back on the show, and we've been talking about doing a show on low-cost launches and some of the ingredients in making that work, I would definitely ask Jim about composite tanks, because he's been doing that for years and has been very successful with it. We have another caller on the show. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you? Where are you?
Hello. My name is Marcio. I'm from London. I've been speaking with you earlier.
Okay.
About the magnesium. Just to let you know, I'm a big fan of SpaceX as well. I love the spaceship too, and its interior is so modern and advanced when it comes to, you know, designing and engineering new ways, because I've never seen something like that. I'll never be able that something like that would be possible in even for a lifetime. But you see, I asked on email, I've sent you before, if I could speak about the engine of levitation.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. So, you see, I've been having a lot of skepticism when it comes to this technology, because obviously a lot of people out there are saying that it's not possible because it breaks Newton's third law. It's not going to be the first technology out there that says it's going to break Newton's third law. But when it comes to the rocket engine, we've been stuck so for so long on the same stage when it comes to space travel, because I don't think we are adopting the right technology to break through these barriers. So that's the reason why, if you don't believe we can actually break laws of physics when it comes to Newton's third law, we're not going to make it out in space, because we actually need to break this one in particular. Newton's third law needs to be broken so that we as humans can actually become space-faring species, and for starters, interplanetary species. But you see, the engine of levitation has actually been in development for almost 4 years now in U.S., in America, actually, in your country, with Davison Design and Marketing Research. And we are working now towards finishing the concept idea and having it on paper and towards a two-year provisional patent application so that we can license it and finally having it on the market. So,
well, you're going to license it and all this, but have you tested it? I mean, where is there evidence that what you're talking about actually works and works in space and can be scaled up for propulsion?
You see, that's the thing. I haven't been allowed yet to put a lot of things about the technology before at least the provisional patent has actually been set to be registered in Washington, D.C. But I'm not allowed yet to put too many things out there. I can tell you that it works for starters with a normal electrical motor because it's going to need rotating propulsion mechanisms. But it's simple mechanical technology that will generate its own thrust and overcome our own Earth's gravitation force field. And once you've done that, that's Newton's third law broken.
So you haven't flown it in space. You haven't made a rocket, or you haven't made a propulsion system.
This is not a rocket. That's the thing. You see, a rocket. You see, this technology is completely against the rocket. Mechanical components put together.
Well, that's fine. So what's the structure of the vehicle you're using to get off of Earth's gravity field?
You see, it's all about the cylinder, and obviously I'm not allowed to speak what's going to be allowed inside the cylinder, but there is an electrical motor.
But it's inside something that looks like a rocket.
Yes, but that's the whole engine itself. So it's going to be wherever spaceship adopts this technology, it's going to have it incorporated on it. It's going to have this engine incorporated on the spaceship.
Where does your funding come from?
The funding, I've been putting money on it myself. You see, when it comes to the engine, when it comes to a space program, it's only, you know, not surprisingly, the problem of funding, having the funding in place, and that has been the issue, to be honest. Otherwise, the patent would already been out there for everyone to see, and for everyone to see that this actually works. It's not the it's not the first technology that says that it's going to break Newton's third law. Obviously, that there's been the M drive that NASA rejected at first, and then the Chinese are developing and reported successful tests about it, and now NASA wants again to adopt the M drive for satellites. But again, it's not even close to what the engine of levitation can do, because the first test we want to, in order to license this and close our first deal, is to prove 100 kilograms vertically taking off from the ground. So we have to prove that as a concept idea, so they can actually close this deal, which is going to be directly towards air defense sector, and we hope to have the funding necessary from this contract towards space commercial, because the engine of levitation as a company wants to keep space commercial. That would be great. I don't know if that's going to be possible, because we cannot afford. We need the giants like the company we're targeting to license the engine of levitation, because it's a lot more money. That, and to be honest, we are struggling with the provisional application for a patent. So,
what is your proposed timeline?
You see, I would love. We have until the end of 2017 to license the engine of levitation, but I would love to do it, within 6 months maximum. That would be great, because a lot more things that need to follow in the timeline and schedule would be done a lot easier.
Why do you only have until the end of this year to license it?
because of the website, the website I've done. So I've as a company, we're promising things to people that in order to keep those promises, we need to follow in schedule. So a space commercials, because that's the sector of the market we want to take. We want to take space commercials. And, you know, once you can, you see, the idea is to use a different technology to travel to space, either than the rocket engine. So that's the idea. And the engine of levitation, by not using any external material, neither Newton's third law, will generate its own thrust, forcing the object upwards, overcoming on Earth's gravitational force field. And that's why all the, you know, skepticism against the engine of levitation, because it does break Newton's third law. It's not the first, obviously, there's the M drive out there again, but it
well,
does.
Well, that's not confirmed. I mean, the papers that have been written say it needs a lot more research, and nobody has any information on what China did or didn't do, although they said they tested it in space. But there's no data about that from China. So the M-drive is still out there as questionable. It could still be an artifact rather than a real change in physics, because to break Newton's third law, you need new physics. And that's not an easy thing to accomplish. I mean, people can say they have new physics, but then where's the scientific evidence of it?
Yeah, that's a lot more work to do. Obviously, again, when it comes to the M drive, it kind of works. I don't believe it breaks Newton's third law, because it does have to generate a proposed mechanism. So the electrical magnetic force field is coming towards the end, so that it can go in the opposite direction. So that for me is that they're claiming that it does break Newton's third law. Not for me, but when it comes to the engine of levitation, the field test that has been done in England, it is possible to do it. Or when it comes to horizontally taking off, and we both know we can make it to space either way, because you see, the engine of levitation will not require the escape velocity like the rocket engine in order to exit the atmosphere. So that's why, that's why this has been invented in the first place, so that everyone can actually afford to go to space. And I believe it's going to be a game changer once it's finally licensed and on the market, because there's a lot of platforms out there, private companies and subcontractors, that a lot of things are going to change out there once this technology finally gets its way into the market.
So what are you attempting to do? Your website doesn't provide a lot of information. So are you
about
attempting...
About
your thing. Are you attempting to raise money, or what is your goal here?
It's very difficult when it comes to raising money. So I'm disclosing the maximum the information that I can. I cannot... you see, there's so many things I cannot do, and that's a shame. Because the provisional patent is not registered yet, not even the provisional one. So there's so many things I cannot disclose. And you see, if this gets out of hand, it would be a problem, because we want, as space pioneers that we are, we want space commercials to go forward and humans to go forward in space. And we don't want any other, kind of hands to actually block the possibilities to do this. So you want to protect it. You want to be the entity owning this to make sure that, whatever program we have in mind actually gets to go forward, and there's no blockage with other authorities and entities involved. So
what do you want Space Show listeners to know about your engine of levitation?
You see, there's the I had a message on my website saying that for all the viewers that the website already had, you know, just under 1,000, if every one of them had, you know, donated at least, you know, let's say in US $10, we would have generated the rest of the necessary funds left for provisional patents.
So you're asking for financial support from people to help you pay for patents?
For the people, exactly.
Here's what I suggest you do. When I archive this program, which will be later today, I know you're 8 hours ahead in London, or early tomorrow morning, California time, I suggest you go ahead and make a post to the blog for this show and explain to listeners the purpose of your call and what you're looking for, because it's not going to be clear to them from the call. Now, I don't know if anybody would support with a donation or not, and in fact, we don't really help other people raise money on the space show, so I'm not able to help you.
I just want to let people know.
But I would suggest you to tell listeners, you know, the purpose of your call and what you're looking for. Post a comment on the blog. Actually, you can post it right now because the blog is already up and running for the show. If you know how to do that, and you can do it as a guest. You don't have to wait until I have the show archived or not, but I will have it archived either very late tonight or very early tomorrow morning, California time. I guess, you know, as things develop with you, keep us posted.
I will.
And hopefully you get your patents and you can show that this is successful.
Show some trust when he comes again or recently, but we need to prove this vertically because he needs to overcome our own Earth's gravitational force field. We need to prove the concept idea. But you see, if you go to the website, it will show you, obviously it will not show you the patent of the engine of gravitation, but we will show you the patent of related technology already on the market, and you can download those for free and see the kind of market sector we want to take as a company.
Okay, and then also if you do post a comment and you want people to be able to get in touch with you, you can give them your email address or contact information, or if they can reach you through your website, then they can contact you.
Yeah, there's two email addresses on my website, and there's a contact field form.
Okay.
If they don't want to use the contact field form, they can email me directly for their own email.
Okay. Well, keep us posted, and I wish you luck with your project.
I will. Can I ask you something, Dr. Uh-huh. What are you going to have Dr. Zivran in your show?
Well, he
you haven't already.
He usually he's been on many, many times over the last 16 years. He usually comes on when he wants something to promote for the Mars Society or when he wants to say something, but he recently posted a rebuttal article which you can read on his website to an article written by two scientists on going to Mars, and I don't have all of this on the top of my head, so I can't really do it. So I know Amanda, I think the former JPL scientist, one of the co-authors, is Amanda Harris, but I'm not sure, MarsSociety.org. But he and I was thinking about asking him if he wanted to come on the show and discuss his
rebuttal. Yeah, I think it's about time, because at least for the last 4 years, I don't know, that I haven't listened to your show.
But he's on all the time. I mean, he's on maybe twice a year. Let me see if I can find his news and announcements. Mars 160, support the Mars show, Ron Howard's Mars.
I mean, I'm a big fan. He's great. I think that's the only option, the only hope we still have is with him. If he's taking the lead to the Martian program, then
that's not happening, but
Well, but, you know, the other guys, Novus is when it comes to Dr. Zubrin.
Yeah, Musk is taking the lead, I think. But, you know, NASA says they have a Mars program, so I don't know. You know, I can't find, I know he posted his article, he always posts his stuff on the Mars Society website, but, you know, I can't.
I'll have a look. I'm always around your website anyway, so.
I can't find the article that I'm talking about. I mean, I have it from one of the magazines that he published it in, but I don't know why I can't. He's changed the Mars Society website.
He was talking about CO2 emissions or making like Earth-like on Mars.
Here, Dr. Robert Zubrin, and then go to news. And see, the American Thinker, okay, so this is Dr. Rubin, major rocket scientist.
He invented a way for humans to actually get artificial oxygen from Mars and be able to breathe it, to actually make their own oxygen. I can't remember exactly, you know, what they've built.
Okay, so
they actually succeeded with that.
He published an article in the American Thinker. Now, I thought this was on his website, but again, I don't know.
I've heard.
So the article is titled, it says December 27th, 2016, Mars is Within Reach by Robert Zubrin. On November 28th, a syndicated op-ed by Charles Wolforth and Amanda Hendricks appeared in the Los Angeles Times and carried over the following days by a number of other newspapers claiming that journeys to Mars are just a dream. Actually, he kind of would be opposed with what Dr. Rowe says, too, and goes on and on and on. So I'm thinking of getting both Amanda and Charles on the show, if they will do it, and having Zubrin also on another show talking about why he thinks their article is not so hot. But
he actually has the whole plan. He actually seen ahead for everything you see this man doing. He's seeing ahead of everything. He already knows the whole way through. So you see, and I believe in his program, and I believe it works. And to be honest, I believe it's the only one that's going to work. And the other ones that are coming now, very late in this stage, you know, I don't think that there's a probability of people coming back alive from new ones. I think it's risk, you know. The people that, you know, take the risk to actually go there, you know, we've got to give them some credit because it's going to take a lot of bravery, a lot of courage. But it could be a one-way ticket.
Well, we'll see. All right, listen, I got to run. Anything else you want to talk about?
That's it.
Okay.
You know, there's so many things I would like to talk to you about, but
all right.
I'm not a guest, at least not yet.
Okay, thank you very much for your call. I appreciate it.
All right, nice one. Thanks a lot, Doctor.
Bye-bye.
See you next time.
Bye-bye. Okay, listeners, so we're at a 2.5-hour program, so I think I'm going to call it a halt for open lines. So I do want to thank everybody for being on the show, for calls, for emails, and for the good variety of discussion topics. And everybody have a great rest of the weekend. Hope it's a good one for you and a good week coming up. So remember, there is no space show program on Friday this coming week, January 20th. I figured we'd lose too much of the audience for the inauguration, and so I we're just going to treat it as a federal holiday day and take it off. So there will be no show on Friday, but there is a Hotel Mars show, which is really interesting. We have the PI of the Psyche asteroid mission that was just recently announced. She is going to be with us. She runs the Arizona State Department of Planetary Resources for this type of thing. And so that is already up on the website newsletter and upcoming shows. And We've got Larry Kuznets back with us on Mars spacesuits, and he's teaching a new spacesuit class at Cal Berkeley, and you want to hear about that. And then, you know, we have good shows tomorrow. Courtney Stad is talking to us about presidential transitions. And then Tuesday night we have a great program planned for you. So I think you'll really enjoy that, and I'll leave that one for you to go look up on the website newsletter or upcoming shows, or to wait patiently for the email newsletter that has come out. I'm not going to tell you everything right off the bat. So again, thanks everybody for calling in and for participating today. And have a great week. Keep it safe and keep looking up. Goodbye from the Space Show.